You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. Now, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to Yahweh his God, as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, Yahweh his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him, and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh, and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Now there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. The rest of the acts of Abijam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam. And Abijam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa his son reigned in his place. In the 20th year of King Jeroboam of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah. And he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And Asa did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh, as David his father had done. He put away the male cult prostitutes out of the land and removed all the idols that his father had made. He also removed Maacah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. But the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to Yahweh all his days. And he brought into the house of Yahweh the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels. And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might permit no one to go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa took all the silver and the gold that were left in the treasuries of the house of Yahweh and the treasuries of the king's house, and gave them into the hands of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, who lived in Damascus, saying, "Let there be a covenant between me and you, as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I am sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go, break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me." And Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel and conquered Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and all Chinnereth, with all the land of Naphtali. And when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah, and he lived in Tirzah. Then King Asa made a proclamation to all Judah. None was exempt, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and its timber, with which Baasha had been building. And with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. Now the rest of all the acts of Asa, all his might and all that he did, and the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? But in his old age he was diseased in his feet. And Asa slept with his fathers, and was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father, and Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his place. Nadab the son of Jeroboam began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel 2 years. He did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in the way of his father, and in his sin which he made Israel to sin. Baasha the son of Ahijah, of the house of Issachar, conspired against him. And Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. For Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon. So Baasha killed him in the 3rd year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. And as soon as he was king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He left to the house of Jeroboam not one that breathed, until he had destroyed it according to the word of Yahweh that he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. It was for the sins of Jeroboam that he sinned, and that he made Israel to sin, and because of the anger to which he provoked Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, began to reign over all Israel at Tirzah, and he reigned 24 years. He did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is, of course, Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 789 of this podcast. Today is Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024, and that was a reading of 1 Kings chapter 15 in the Old Testament. Pretty gangsta, not gonna lie. A little bit like Bloods and Crips, Hatfields and McCoys. Well, I don't know if you can say that the Hatfields and the McCoys were gangsters, but they feuded. They did. They had beef and they squabbled. And so also, as you can tell, Judah and Israel, though closely related, though Judah being one of the 12 tribes, you would think they would get along better. This just goes to show that any sort of distinction between people can and will, when combined with a sinful nature, produce an excuse or an excuse factory for being awful and having conflict. But here we find in 1 Kings 15 as good an introduction to the topic we're going to be covering at the latter half of this episode, which is to say, we're going to be talking about Claudine Gay, who just recently, very, very recently, resigned from being president of Harvard University amid scandal regarding plagiarism, serial plagiarism. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk a bit about how various white-collar professions are trending far to the left and how somebody made a graph time-lapsed to show year over year the political persuasion, political spectrum alignment of various professions that are important in the U.S. in the white-collar classification. We'll talk about higher education. We'll talk about academia and everything needing to be certified, everything needing to be licensed, and people needing degrees and diplomas, and why is that, and where is that going? We'll talk about that in the latter half of this episode, but for the first half, or thereabouts, we're going to talk about 1 Kings chapter 15 here, and I'll explain as we go how I think these things are related. First up, Abijam. Abijam begins to reign over Judah in the 18th year of King Jeroboam. He reigns for 3 years, not a long tenure as king. His mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom, and he walked in all the sins that his father did before him. That's why his reign was so short. 3 years, not very long. Well, maybe you shouldn't have been fooling about. Maybe you shouldn't have been doing the evil that your father had done. It says here, verse 3, his heart was not wholly true to Yahweh his God as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, Yahweh his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem because David did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh. Did not turn aside, it says, from anything that he, that is God, commanded him, that is David, all the days of his life, which is something that was said in the previous chapter as well, except here there's an except. Except here, there's a but. Except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Well, thank you. I was going to say it in the previous chapter, but then I thought, well, it's not in the text, though. So perhaps it's just supposed to stand. In this chapter, for some reason, it does need to be qualified. And I don't know why that is. I'm not quite sure. All I know for sure is that it is qualified here, the latter half of verse 5. David did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. So we have to mention that. But, verse 6, there was war now between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. Whose life? Abijam's life. The rest of the acts of Abijam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles? That is, the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, which we will be getting into just next. After 1 and 2 Kings, of course, you have 1 and 2 Chronicles. But it says here, there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam, and Abijam slept with his fathers, which is to say that he died, and they buried him in the city of David. Then comes his son. Abijam has a son named Asa. Asa ascends to the throne. This is the law of primogeniture, if you've heard of that. But what you may have missed, and it happened fast, and it was subtle, but this is fascinating and disturbing, but it's in the text. Who was Asa's mother? Asa's father, it says, was Abijam. Abijam was the son of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was the son of Solomon. Solomon was the son of David. And so this is the great-grandson, Asa is, of David. That's the patrilineal descent. That's the line of descent from the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather. But what about Asa's mother? Who was Asa's mother? Well, it says here, his mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom. Well, what's the big deal about that? Why is she named? I mean, no offense, but who cares who his mother was? What was the name of Abijam's mother? His mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Wait, 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 wait. Time out, time out, time out. No, 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 no. Do you mean to suggest? No, I don't mean to suggest. I'm just going to say it outright. The mother of Asa was the same mother as Abijam had, which is to say that, not even having to read too hard between the lines, Abijam got with his mother, and Asa was their son. And that's what I'm seeing in the text. Maybe she was very young when Jeroboam took her to be his wife, and she was young enough that she was still quite young when Abijam came of age. I don't know. I don't know. But this is just a little bit, in passing, not to dwell on it, of the sin and the wickedness that marked Rehoboam. And this is the kind of wickedness that you will find in a culture, in a society, in a nation, in a people, when they also have things like male cult prostitutes, when they have worship of false gods, when anything goes religiously, anything goes spiritually. Don't be surprised when anything goes sexually and you get this sort of a occurrence, this sort of an aberration. But it says, verse 11, Asa did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh, as David his father had done. So whether Asa came from an incestuous pairing of essentially his father and his mother was also his grandmother, or not, Asa had his own choices to make. And it says here that he did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh. He had a good long reign, 41 years, much longer than his father Abijam's reign, which was only 3 years long. But it says in verse 12, he put away the male cult prostitutes out of the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. He also removed Maakah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. So here we see that she's not just some victim, right? If that would be your go-to instinct to say, oh, poor Maakah, whoever she was, let's just assume that this was forced on her or whatever. No, no. She was an idolater. She worshipped the gods of the foreign nations. She had an ashram of her own that she had made. And oh, by the way, remember that Rehoboam was not just the son of Solomon. Rehoboam was also the son of an Ammonite woman. And the Ammonites were one of the peoples that Israel had been told by God, commanded by God, not to intermarry with. And this was the reason. And we see here multi-generationally how that works out, how that turns out when it starts with idolatry. It doesn't stop there. It'll also extend to sexual immorality, not just in a general sense, not just condoning, but also participating, even in your own household, even in the royal household, this is happening. And if it's happening in the royal household, in the royal family, do you think it's not happening in the broader culture, in the broader society of the tribe of Judah, the kingdom of Judah now? It says here, verse 13, that Asa removed Maacah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. Was he dishonoring his mother, or was he honoring God? I'm going to go with he was honoring God. It says, verse 14, but the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to Yahweh all his days, and he brought into the house of Yahweh the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels. Now, it's interesting in part here to me, besides what a mess Asa must have been in so many ways to have this be the dynamic he walked into, the dynamic he was born into, the dynamic he was conceived in. Besides that, it says here that his heart, so his own personal devotion, was wholly for God alone, for Yahweh alone. And yet it says the high places were not taken away. And I wonder about this, if it just wasn't an option. The pagan worship of these foreign gods was too well entrenched, and it was too difficult to dislodge it. And so what does he do? He starts at least with his own household. He starts at least with removing his own mother from being the queen mother and cutting down her Asherah. And maybe that was all he could do. Maybe he was constrained, and his administration, his cabinet, his advisors, his public servants at the highest levels wouldn't let him do anymore. He would give an order and they just wouldn't obey it. They just wouldn't follow it. That's a possibility in any event. Verse 16, there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah that he might permit no one to go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. So we have something like a siege happening, and the noose is tightening. And what we see next is part of what enables Israel and Israel's king to relate this way to Judah and Judah's king and the people of Judah who want to be able to get to their king, and also the people of Israel, perhaps, maybe, to get to Judah's king, if Judah's king is a more righteous king and Israel's king is a wicked king. Maybe he is nursing some of the fear of Jeroboam that the people of Israel would go back to the house of David under Asa. Part of what enables this is a covenant between Israel and Syria. It says here, King Asa sent his servants with treasures of the king's house, treasures of the house of Yahweh, to give the treasures to Ben-Hadad, son of Tabrimon, son of Hezion, king of Syria, who lived in Damascus, saying, verse 19, let there be a covenant between me and you, as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I am sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me. What is Asa doing here? He is getting at a supply line, a support that is essential for Baasha to keep on doing this thing where he's essentially going to isolate Judah. This is an encirclement that, if successful, will not just keep anyone from going to Asa. It'll keep Asa, by extension, from being king. He won't be able to function and operate as king, which is to say, you basically just choke out his capacity to rule, and then he's not king anymore. You know, think if this were a wrestling match, if this were a fight in an alleyway, It's the equivalent of putting the other guy in a sleeper hold, and you just keep that pressure and you increase that pressure until they pass out. And then that's that. And you do whatever you want at that point because they're done. That's what Baasha is trying to do. And Asa is going to interrupt it by sending quite a lot of gift to Syria to break off the covenant that Syria has with Israel. What do you know? It works. Verse 20, Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel. So all of a sudden, Israel has to deal with, instead of a friend, an enemy. And now Syria is conquering Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Ma'aka, and Olchinareth with all the land of Naphtali. And it says, when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah, and he lived in Tirzah. So he lost his appetite. All of a sudden, instead of being able to focus on trying to choke out Judah and choke out Asa, he's got to worry about even holding on to Israel. Wild stuff. Verse 22, then King Asa made a proclamation to all Judah, none was exempt, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and its timber with which Baasha had been building, and with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. Now the rest of all the acts of Asa, all his might, all that he did, the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And yes, they are. But it says this little bit about Asa at the very last. In his old age, he was diseased in his feet. And Asa slept with his fathers, that is to say that he died. He was buried with his fathers, which is to say he shared a tomb with his fathers, or right next to the tombs of his fathers, his forefathers, in the city of David, his father. Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place. But then, ever so briefly, what's this about the disease in his feet? Is this an indication that Asa was a bad guy and he was being punished? Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he had this disease in his feet in his old age? Is this proof that he actually had not wholly been devoted to Yahweh? I would say no. I would say that this is not proof. And just like it was a bad question, it was a wrong-headed question that Jesus was asked about the man who was born blind. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus said, neither. It may be, and this is my first thought, this is speculative, but I think it's reasonable to speculate, it may be that Asa had this disease in his feet related to his mother being his grandmother. That's a possibility. It's a strong possibility that this had something to do with the genetics. In any event, verse 25, Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. He reigned over Israel 2 years, so an even shorter reign than Abijam. The son of Rehoboam, the son of Jeroboam, on average, 2.5 years. Not even a full American presidential term. I mean, brief time as kings. But it says, he did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in the way of his father, and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. So this is not just, if you'll remember, that Abijah, the prophet from Shiloh, pronounced this judgment, and you think, oh, but that's not fair to the rest of the house of Jeroboam, that the house of Jeroboam is going to be cursed in this way for the sins of Jeroboam. How is that fair? Well, no. Hold on. Wait a second. Nadab, son of Jeroboam, did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. So it wasn't just who his father was. It was that he also participated in these things. And in contrast to Asa, for instance, who had a wicked father, who had a wicked grandfather, who had a wicked mother and grandmother, and they were the same person. In the case of Nadab, he didn't just have a wicked father in Jeroboam, he also was wicked himself. So verse 27 says, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, now that's interesting, is this the same Ahijah, the old prophet from Shiloh? Says, Baasha, the son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, conspired against him, and Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, for Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon. So Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. And as soon as he was king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He left to the house of Jeroboam not one that breathed, until he had destroyed it according to the word of Yahweh that he spoke by his servant Ahijah, interesting, the Shilonite. It was for the sins of Jeroboam that he sinned, and that he made Israel to sin, and because of the anger to which he provoked Yahweh, the God of Israel. You know, it's one thing to be annoying, and some people are just especially good at being annoying, being irritating. It's quite another thing when you find your pleasure in life out of trying to be annoying to God, trying to be irritating to him. Oh, he doesn't like this? I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to watch to see what happens. Well, what you see happening may just be that you get struck. You might want to not do that. That's extraordinarily foolish. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, which is to say that you willy-nilly or even systematically provoking God is about as foolish as it gets. Verse 33, in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, began to reign over all Israel at Tirzah, and he reigned 24 years, which is a pretty decent amount of time, longer than 2 years, longer than 3 years by a good bit, actually 10 times as long as the average, just about, between those two reigns, the reign of the son of Jeroboam, the reign of the son of Rehoboam. But verse 34 says, he did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. And so even though he's not descended from Jeroboam, he also is going to do the things that Jeroboam did that brought the judgment. And so he's going to get the same sort of a outcome. And these people just don't learn. You talk about stiff-necked, stubborn, foolish, ignorant. But did I pass over something? I think I passed over Baasha and what he did to the house of Jeroboam. It says here, verse 29, as soon as he was king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He left to the house of Jeroboam no one that breathed until he had destroyed it according to the word of Yahweh that he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. Now that's pretty brutal. But then in a previous generation, what might have taken more of an indirect, subtle tact to prevent people from going back to the former house that ruled over the kingdom. Say, for instance, how Jeroboam had made the two golden calves to keep the people of Israel from going back to the house of David. In Baasha's case, if he's a wicked man and he's not really personally inspired by wanting to serve God, oh, God wants this thing done. And so that's what I want to do because I want to please God. If you're not personally motivated, the other reason he might do this thing is just to completely eliminate the possibility of anybody ever going back to a descendant of Jeroboam. Burn the ships. Cut off the escape route. It's just you and me, Israel, and I'm your king. So you're going to do what I say because I'm going to eliminate anybody else who would have a claim to the throne, lest you get the notion that you're going to appoint a descendant of Jeroboam to be king instead of me, if you decide you don't like me at a certain point. And yet, whether it was at all personally inspired and motivated by a desire to please God on the part of Baasha, or whether it was entirely Machiavellian, and he maybe made some allusion to it being prophesied, but meanwhile, privately, he was just this reprobate, evil, corrupt guy, merciless, cruel, ruthless. At the end of the day, what was accomplished is what God had pronounced in the way of judgment against the house of Jeroboam. And that's an important thing for us to recognize about God, that just because he uses this or that person, this or that people or nation, that doesn't mean that everything that they're doing as they're accomplishing his purposes is good or sanctified. There's a mystery to this, and you can get carried away saying, well, it's God himself who is doing the evil. No, no. Well, then it's God himself who's tempting this man to do what is evil. No, no. Nope, 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 nope. James says, no one should say when tempted, God is tempting me. Because God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. Each man is led away by his own sinful desires. That is to say, Baasha was led away by his own sinful desires. Jeroboam was led away by his own sinful desires. Rehoboam was led away by his own sinful desires. The consequences that they and those around them suffer are justly deserved consequences. When various men are wholly devoted to God and they do whatever they can in service to God, maybe it's a little, maybe it's a lot. See also Asa not being able to, it seems to me, remove the high places, but he was able to cut down and burn his mother's Asherah and remove her from being the queen mother. You know, either way, God is just. He is righteous. He is fair. And if our first thought is to question his justice and question his fairness, or to deny it outright, we are not so wise. We are not so sophisticated and so smart as we think we are. And watch out, because we will probably, in the very next iteration of our relating to God, go the way of these wicked kings with whatever authority we have, whether it's a lot or it's a little. It's not really the most important thing to God. If you're faithful with a little bit and you accomplished a little, the story of the widow's mite would instruct you that God is very pleased with that. If you have quite a lot, and then in proportion to what the widow gave, you give quite a lot more than she gave, but in proportion to what you had to give, you gave very, very little. God's less impressed with that than we typically are. And we should know that. And so also, if a person has the capacity to do a little bit of evil, not a lot, but a little bit of evil, and they restrain themselves, and somebody else has the capacity to do a great deal of evil, and they let themselves go here and there with relatively minor things, as long as we keep the sin, you know, on a low boil, on the back burner, we'll just keep it around, keep it hot. God knows. And God knows better than we do, and yet he gives us his word here to have some insight into how he's operating, because again, as I've said before, I'll say it again and again and again, because we need to keep hearing it and we need to keep knowing it. We are not personally any of the figures, any of the characters in this chapter. And our country is not any of the countries or nations in this chapter that I just read. Look cover to cover, and you will not find a reference to the United States of America. And you won't find a reference directly to yours truly. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not contained in some larger category of people referenced. I'm not saying that, but the bigger deal is God is still God. He's the same yesterday, today, forever. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that means what you learn about God's character in 1 Kings chapter 15, for instance, that's still good. Check the expiration date. There isn't one. But that's all we'll say about 1 Kings chapter 15 for this chapter of our podcasting. And next, let's get into talking a little bit about academia and being intellectual. First up, Virginia Cruda over at the Daily Wire has some reporting. Claudine Gay may still rake in nearly $900,000 a year despite ouster as Harvard prez. Yes, you heard that right. Nearly $1 million. She has a massive six-figure salary, which she may still get to collect, even though she resigned. Gay announced her resignation Tuesday amid allegations of plagiarism in her published academic works and closely following her disastrous Capitol Hill testimony addressing rampant anti-Semitism on campuses such as hers. But according to a report published that same day by the New York Post, she may simply return to her previous positions as a professor or as dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. According to the report, Gay reported income of $824,068 in 2020 and $879,079 in 2021, and she may have broken into seven figures if she had been able to hold on to her position as university president. Her predecessor, Lawrence S. Bacow, pulled in a salary of $1.3 million in 2021. That's an incredible amount of money to be president of Harvard. I bring this up because despite her having been caught red-handed doing what seems to be among the academics and scholars and the credible folks who play gatekeeper to the professional world, to public life, the unpardonable sin is supposed to be plagiarism. Despite her having been found to have repeatedly plagiarized other people's works in her academic works, which is to say how she established herself as a credible expert in the first place, was basically stealing other people's ideas and passing them off as her own, trying to punch above her weight class, if you will, so to give the impression that she was smarter than she really was, more insightful, more wise, more informed than she really was. Despite her having been caught doing that, her resignation doesn't necessarily keep her from collecting most of $1 million a year at Harvard. That's incredible. That's an incredible thing for us all to see. And if it's true, if it ends up being the case, it's an incredibly damaging and destructive signal to everybody who looks up to Harvard still or thinks that Harvard is a standard of credibility, of integrity, of robustness of intellect and character. So many very smart, very credentialed, very authoritative people have gotten into positions of prominence in America, whether it's economic prominence, whether it's cultural significance, whether it's intellectual significance, being able to say they went to Harvard, they graduated, if they were a professor, if they were president of Harvard University, all the more so to say that not just everybody associated with Harvard, but everybody who's been pressured for decades to kowtow and defer and avert their eyes, go down on one knee as somebody from Harvard passes by or is speaking, that everybody would possibly see her resign and yet still collect all of this money per year from being employed by Harvard. It's a very real prospect, and it's a sign of the times. Claudine Gay is an intersectional woman, and she's also said the sort of things that have passed among the left for being savvy and sophisticated. And essentially, she has been an emblem for the left of the change that they're wanting to see in the world. And so that's why the left is loath to admit that she really messed up and to provide significant consequences. If she were a conservative, she would not have been in the position she got into as president of Harvard. But if she had anyways become president of Harvard, and then she was found to be guilty of plagiarism, the response would be entirely opposite. It wouldn't just be that she was fired and couldn't hold a job at Harvard ever again. It would be that they were burning her in effigy in the streets. They would not be able to find language strong enough. They would do everything, pull out all the stops to strip her of all honors, all titles, all degrees, all diplomas, all certifications, all licenses, everything that they possibly could so as to distance themselves from her and to destroy her credibility. And yet, because she's very intersectional and because she was saying the kinds of nuanced, sophisticated, critical race affirming, radical left affirming things that she was saying, even though she's guilty of plagiarism, they're loath to punish her. So she's the one who resigns. She's not fired. She resigns. If this is what passes for an academic and an intellectual in the year 2024 now, 3 days in, it's still fresh this new year, but we're there. If this is what passes for an intellectual and an academic, if this is emblematic of how the gatekeeping to the highest echelons of the professional world, the corporate world, public life, public service, think and how they operate and how they have two standards of justice, two sets of weights and measures, then I think that the conservatives of all kinds, social, fiscal, political, philosophical, and religious conservatives, and very often they're the same people, I think that the conservatives can be forgiven for saying, if that's what you guys are selling, I'm not buying. And the trap is that a lot of conservatives, I think, for quite some time, going back to the days of J. Gresham Machen, a lot of conservatives have been forced out systematically. And then the people who still have the talking stick, who are allowed to stick around in these most prestigious of institutions of higher learning, folks like Mark Knoll, for instance, they say, hey, where did all the conservatives go? Where did all the Christians go? And the folks who still have the talking stick, they've been palatable enough, they've been tolerable to the radical left, and the liberals who took over our universities around about a century ago, those folks say, it's the conservatives' fault that they left higher education, that they gave up on professorships, and they went and started new colleges, new universities. It's the conservatives' fault that they abandoned these institutions. And of course, Claudine Gay types get to the very top. But not so fast, right? Not so fast. Going back to 1 Kings chapter 15 for a little bit, recognize the coercive and manipulative effect of the person at the very top saying, this is the new paradigm. This is the new religion. Not for no reason does Asa remove his mother from being the queen mother. If she was his mother and his grandmother, well, that's a good reason. It's not the cited reason, though. The cited reason is that she had made an Asherah pole for herself, which is to say she had made a symbol for herself to associate herself with the worship of the gods of the nations instead of Yahweh God. And so she was symbolic. She was emblematic of this false worship, which was the new paradigm. That was going to be the new normal for Judah and for Israel, that they worshiped the gods of the nations and became just like the nations, but worse, actually. Just as bad as the peoples and the nations God had driven out before Israel. And yet, Asa, if he had a whole lot of people in his administration who were not willing to have the high places completely done away with and tore down, Asa did what he could in removing his mother from being queen mother and cutting down her Asherah pole and burning it and keeping Judah independent from Israel. And you say, but how does that relate to this higher education business? How does that relate to being an intellectual or being an academic? Well, it relates very much, because even if you do have a more conservative person who gets into a position of authority, if everybody the next level down who serves under them in that same institution is either pro-idolatry, so to speak, or they're at least anti-upsetting the apple cart, anti-doing anything about it, that can make it very difficult to impossible for the conservative at the very top to actually accomplish what it is that they have in their heart to do, to roll back the corruption and the rot. But the flip side is, for all the reasons that it was significant that Asa's mother was queen mother and also she had built an Asherah for herself, if you get decades of leadership over institutions like Harvard, building the intellectual equivalent of an Asherah pole, setting up high places, you know, higher education, yeah, but higher than what? Is it actually so high? I guess that's the point. Just because you put it in a high place, that doesn't mean that it deserves that lofty attention, that lofty prestige. And yet, it's conservatives who get blamed for having abandoned these institutions. If you guys wouldn't have abandoned Harvard, then we wouldn't be in this mess in the first place. No. Time and again, in the biblical text, we find that so-and-so became king over Israel, or so-and-so became king over Judah. And how did they walk? How did they lead? What we don't find is Asa became king, and you know what? It was really so-and-so who cut down the queen mother's Asherah pole and burned it. No, Asa did it. If he was the one giving the orders, he was the one who did it. And if not everybody was on board with that, well, guess what? That's part of the reason why you do it. But then the flip side is also true. We find wicked kings, and it says they became king, and they did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and they followed after the example set by their father or their grandfather who was wicked and who did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. And they, like Jeroboam, didn't just sin themselves, they also made Israel to sin. And that's the language. That's what's in the text. Verse 26 of 1 Kings 15. He did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. That is Nadab, son of Jeroboam. He did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh and walked in the way of his father and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. We say elections have consequences. Also, who you put in charge of institutions, that has consequences. We know that it has consequences. You can't say on the one hand, well, it's not really that big of a deal. And then on the other hand, we look at how much somebody like Claudine Gay is being paid, nearly $1 million a year, and say, yeah, so what? That sort of money is paid because the belief is, the perception is, among all the people who helped to make it possible to pay that kind of a salary, whoever is in this position makes a great deal of difference. They have a huge amount of influence, outsized influence, not just over current students, current faculty, but also alumni, also prospective future students and their families, also everybody else who is impressed with this institution. The reluctance to fire Claudine Gay, and even the prospect of her still retaining a job with Harvard and collecting nearly $1 million a year, is quite the indication that the folks who make it possible for her to retain a position or retain that kind of a salary are still very much committed to their false ideas, their false ideals, their false convictions, their false anthropology, and yes, their very bad theology, because that's how this all got started in the first place. The waywardness of Harvard theologically is upstream of the chaos and the confusion and the craziness and the folly and the inanity of Harvard today, as indicated in this Claudine Gay business. Until we're prepared to believe that and to act like that's true, we will just get more and more of this, and it will make things worse and worse. This will be a very emboldening thing for other people who are like Claudine Gay to say there's essentially very little to no consequence. Maybe she didn't like being president. Maybe she was just tired of the job. Maybe she didn't want to be president anymore anyways, and if she still gets to collect a really big salary, it's kind of a win for her and everybody else who gets to see her keep her position and keep on collecting a salary like this. And they will think likewise, I can do whatever. I can be a radical. And if I'm a radical, I can plagiarize other people's work and I won't suffer consequences for it. I will only get benefits. Yeah, I'll get a little bit of a dust up with conservatives who are trying to push back on this in higher education, but they won't be able to do anything. It'll actually be satisfying to see them so stirred up about it, if anything. For our next story, though, and very much of a piece with this, and to prove how important it is, how essential the influence of higher education is in our economy, in our political process, in our country, consider Commodore Vanderbilt's post from New Year's Day of this year at Not the Bee. This researcher compiled videos showing how different professions have shifted far left over the past decades. The one about accountants threw me for a loop. I can't spend much time on this. I can only recommend you check out the link in the description for this podcast episode. Go over to Not the Bee. Look at the graphs. He's got these posted to X, formerly known as Twitter. Kevin Bass is his name, or maybe it's Bass. Kevin Bass, Kevin Bass. He's a PhD. It says in his X profile, PhD MS. But he's got here time-lapse graphs of the political ideology of various white-collar professionals in the U.S. Some of these go back to 1980 and come forward to 2020. Others start in the year 2000 and come forward to the year 2020. But it's pretty remarkable. He's got one here for tech professionals, one for professors in academia, one for American teachers, one for American psychologists, one for American accountants, one for engineers, one for nurses, one for physicians, one for those in the legal profession, attorneys, lawyers, etc. Whatever graph you're looking at, you can see little bubbles of increase here and there for conservatives. Some of these professions were much more heavily conservative than they were liberal, or much more on the right than they were on the left decades ago. And over the last 2 to 4 decades, we've seen a remarkable shift to where a lot, and not just a few, a lot describe themselves. Most, the vast majority of these professions self-identify as either left or very left. And What do they have in common? What do tech professionals and professors and teachers and psychologists and accountants and engineers and nurses and physicians and lawyers, what do they all have in common? They all are getting an education in our public schools or in our universities. And they have to go to good ones if they want to stick to it. If they want to get a job and they want to be a professional about this, they have to stick to it. The universities have been wokeifying and they've been radicalizing our white-collar personnel. And I think this is the ultimate fulfillment of Saul Alinsky's vision in Rules for Radicals. The real radical who's going to accomplish lasting, meaningful change politically and culturally is the one who combs his hair, trims his beard, puts on a suit and tie, and walks into work with a briefcase. And just a little bit every day, incrementally, over time, radicalizes the institutions that he shows up to work at. Like Claudine Gay, for example, but by no means limited to Claudine Gay. If you radicalize and make very left and left the doctrine that the K through 12 and higher education institutions are imparting to their charges, well, then you can also weed out thereby and discourage and demoralize and fail the conservatives so that the conservatives give up and drop out of school and go do something else. And then not only have you captured the schools and the universities, you've also captured those professions that require a degree from higher education, require a degree from a university, from a medical school, from a law school, etc. And that's what's happened. That's what's happened over the last 2 to 4 decades, especially in earnest. The left has been very good at this, and conservatives, for the most part, get beat over the head for supposedly being uneducated, unsophisticated, unintelligent, unsuccessful. Ah, but if the gatekeepers, right? If the gatekeepers are playing this game and they have the full endorsement of their conscience in doing so because it's social justice, what guilt do they bear? At what point do you say, this is not the conservatives who voluntarily were just like, yeah, I'm out. Sure, they made choices. But if the choices were, you either stay and we neuter your conservative voice, your conservative influence, your conservative convictions, you either stay and be a good boy and play by the rules and just keep it to yourself, or else we'll fail you. And then you'll have all this college debt to pay back, but you won't have the degree. You won't have the license. You won't have the certification. You won't have the credential. You won't have whatever it is. The institutions captured by the radical left bear the majority of the guilt here. And it's not the conservatives who are just anti-intellectual, anti-being a professional. It's the folks who believe that man is a machine because they've fully bought into the modern conception of God, which is to say that God is dead and we've killed him. Carl Truman, in his piece for First Things magazine, the January issue, writes about how we need to add a third component to our understanding of the modern dysfunction. The modern social imaginary is not just about disenchantment and liquidity. You know, everything's changing all the time, and you really shouldn't be enchanted by things that you don't understand. Everything can be broken down to its parts, and if you can explain it in materialistic terms purely, well then, it's all just processes, right? It's all just processes happening, but then in the process of it all being processes and becoming all processes to us, man loses his agency. So you're not responsible for your achievements if you do really well, and you're also not at fault if you do what you shouldn't do. It was just processes, evolutionary processes, economic processes, political processes, business. It's just business. You'll hear people say, usually right before or right as they're doing something highly unethical, very cutthroat. But there is a desecration of man, relative man having been made in God's image. And if we sense that, and if the most staunch conservatives, the most strong-minded, strong-willed, and yes, even possibly the smartest, the most independent, the strongest conservatives, if they sense that intuitively and they kick back against it and they say, nope, I don't want that. I don't want to flatter that. I don't want to play that game. I'm not about that. The people who have the talking stick, who stay in these captive institutions, will just say, ah, what a loser. And that contributes as well to this being what it is. We should not be surprised. Now, what's interesting about Kevin Bass, PhD, MS, Commodore Vanderbilt, says he's a medical student and researcher who publicly admitted that he and many in the scientific community were wrong about COVID lockdowns and mandates. Since then, the guy seems to have taken a pretty massive red pill. He's the guy who published these graphs. You should check them out. See for yourself. But back to Claudine Gay. Going to The Blaze and some reporting from Joseph McKinnon, we find Harvard President Claudine Gay resigns in disgrace, paints herself as a victim of racial animus, of course. Claudine Gay threw in the towel Tuesday, resigning as president of Harvard University after getting hit with 6 new plagiarism complaints. Not 1, not 2, not 3, 6 complaints. Gay said in a possibly original letter to the school community, quote, "It is with a heavy heart, but a deep love for Harvard, that I write to share that I will be stepping down as president. This is not a decision I came to easily," end quote. Quote, "After consultation with members of the corporation," that's curious, but they are a corporation, "it has become clear that it is in the best interests of Harvard for me to resign so that our community can navigate this moment of extraordinary challenge with a focus on the institution rather than any individual," she continued. Gay painted herself as a victim, suggesting she found it frightening, quote, "to be subjected to personal attacks and threats fueled by racial animus," end quote. The outgoing president indicated she would be returning to the faculty, quote, "and to the scholarship and teaching that are the lifeblood of what we do," end quote. Gay became the 30th president of Harvard University on July 1st, after evidently playing up her leftist bona fides as Edgar Lee, dean of Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences, where she brought new emphasis to climate alarmism and identity politics. Ahead of her inauguration, Gay stated, quote, "Today we are in a moment of remarkable and accelerating change, socially, politically, economically, and technologically," end quote. It appears that Gay was unable to keep up with the accelerated change. Now we'll just stop right there. It's important to note that it's not racial animus, and yet this is the gift that keeps on giving for the folks who claim that they're pursuing racial justice or social justice more broadly. If caught in any transgression, they play the victim, because they just overlay everything that gave them license in their own minds to do what they shouldn't have done, to not do what they should have done. To this point, they overlay that onto now they're being held accountable and, yes, even disciplined, even just questioned about it. Like they have done wrong. It's so much easier if all you're ever doing is pointing out systemic problems. It's so much easier than having to admit that you personally have been corrupt. You have done what was wicked. You've done what was dishonest and even evil. If the ends justify the means, and oh, by the way, if it's all just a moment of remarkable and accelerating change, socially, politically, economically, and technologically, then what we're really talking about is processes. It's just processes, right? Socially, well, that would seem to be very personal, but if it's just processes, well, it's the most impersonal thing in the world. Politically, politically, that's people making decisions together, except there too, you see it as so many processes. You don't see people made in the image of God, responsible for their choices, accountable to God, and also given a special dignity by virtue of being made in his image. You don't see that. You just see political processes, political systems are changing. But the fundamental nature of man is not changing. The fundamental nature of justice is not changing. We're in a moment of remarkable and accelerating change economically. Well, that's just to say that it's processes. It's not radical schemes of redistributive social justice, socialism, communism, being perpetuated by covetous people, envious people, malicious, bitter, scheming, dishonest people. No, no. Nope. It's just economic processes evolving technologically. Oh, okay. Yeah, but who made the technology, right? It's people driving a certain kind of change because they've been influenced by ideas. And those ideas, on some level, are choices. you choose to entertain certain ideas of other people, which is to say you allow somebody else's ideas to be guests in your mind, in your heart, and then at a certain point you just say, well, you could just live here forever. I'll adopt you as my own. Now you're part of the family. I'm going to marry you to my daughter. I'm going to marry you to my son. And now this is my idea. Those are choices. And those choices are very, very similar to the kinds of choices that we see play out in 1 Kings 15. It's passed over very briefly, but the name of Asa's mother was also the same name as the mother of Abijah, Asa's father, which is to say that his mother was his grandmother. It's not supposed to work like that. And if you just pass over it very quickly, then it's like, yeah, okay, whatever. You stop, you pause, you consider, and then it's like, whoa, wait a second. And maybe the game was to say, well, you know, it's just been a very tough time for all of us, right? You play the victim, called out for having made the Asherah pole and worshiping the gods of the foreign nations. You say, well, you know, you just don't know. You just don't understand how difficult it's been being the wife of Rehoboam, you know, being daughter-in-law of Solomon. I mean, Rehoboam, his mother was an Ammonite. They're an oppressed people. They were a marginalized people. You know, the Israelites, they weren't allowed to marry Ammonites. So you just don't even know how difficult it was. Well, wait a second. Wait. Your starting position is how you feel. Your starting position is what you want. Your starting position is supposed to be, what did God say? What did he say to do that was good? What did he say to not do that was evil? And what choices did you make relative to what God said to be about? That is supposed to be the starting position. When for higher education and so much increasingly over the last 2 to 4 decades, the professional world, the most respected white-collar professions in American society, if the starting position has increasingly been for more and more of these professionals, more and more of these academics, professors and teachers, et cetera, for starters, that it's what I feel, it's what I want, it's liberal theology, it's a false gospel, well, then it's no wonder we're in the trouble that we are. And when they say, trust the experts, that's as close as they get to saying, put your faith in God, because they are their own gods. They do what is right in their own eyes, and there's no fear of God before their eyes. And so in their expertise, which they help to reinforce the illusion of for one another, they give some very bad counsel. And if they're in a position of authority and power, they give very damaging, very destructive, and sometimes even cruel and capricious mandates. You will do this. Well, but what if it's very oppressive? What if it's very unjust? They've stopped listening. They don't listen to you because you don't have the degrees. And if they work in big tech, maybe they are the reason why you don't have an audience to speak of. They just dial you down, even if you were an expert, even if you made it through, right? How discouraging is that? You make it through, you get the degree, you get the medical license, you get the license to practice law, you get the fill in the blank, you become an engineer for some big corporation, you're making lots of money, and here come the DEI initiatives. Here comes the newspeak, and you say something from your position of expertise that challenges that, and it's totally true, it's totally legitimate, totally credible, but it's totally inconvenient. And all of a sudden, you see associations, various credentialing bodies and boards talking openly about maybe revoking your license to practice, but also revoking essentially your license to be taken seriously. And they've already prejudged that the outcome must be affirming of DEI. So it's a new orthodoxy, but then that is to say it's a new religion. They're acting like it's a new religion. It's totally reasonable for us to take them seriously. That yes, in fact, they do have a new religion. It's this hybrid of worship of Yahweh, if there's still any trapping of Christianity in the mix, like what the motto used to be for Harvard, Christo et Ecclesia, for Christ and church. Now it's just Veritas, which means truth. And any Harvard alumni may ask, what is truth? Like Pontius Pilate, and be forgiven. And maybe that's really the hidden rest of the motto, what is truth? But that's the official seal still of Harvard Corporation. Christo et Ecclesia, for Christ and Church. If that's still mixed in a little bit and they have more credibility because they have kind of the appearance of religion, but it's a false religion, now imagine that same sort of a dynamic in play 100% in Israel and Judah, as there's worship of Yahweh right alongside worship of the gods of the nations. And all of the sexual immorality, all of the violence, all of the dishonesty, all of the confusion, all of the oppression that comes along with worshiping the gods of the nations. This is why God found it so unacceptable when kings, even Solomon, who was the son of David, and who had pleased God so much with asking for wisdom, even Solomon, having been disobedient, has the kingdom taken away in the days of Rehoboam, his son. Now, lastly here, because I really am coming up on a hard stop here, and I gotta go, I'm gonna play for you a short clip from the movie Good Will Hunting. And I'll leave you with that, and we'll pick this up again soon enough in our next episode, this topic of getting a credential, going to college. But here it is, cut one from the movie Good Will Hunting, starring Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Robin Williams. Take a listen.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
So do you ladies...
Come here often?
Do I come here? I come here a bit. I'm here, you know, from time to time. Do you go to school here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. So I think I had a class with you.
Oh, yeah? What class?
History.
Maybe.
Yes, I think that's what it was. You don't necessarily... I not remember me, you know, I like it here. It doesn't mean because I go here I'm a genius. I am very smart. Hey, how's it going? How are you?
Good, how you doing?
You want it?
What class did you say that was?
History.
Yeah.
Just history? It must have been a survey course then, huh?
Yeah, it was surveys.
Right.
You should check it out. It's a good course. It'd be a good class.
Oh. How'd you like that course?
You know, frankly, I found the class, you know, rather elementary.
Elementary. Yeah. You know, I don't doubt that it was.
Yeah.
I remember that class. It was, it was just between recess and lunch.
Clark, why don't you go away?
Why don't you relax?
Why not go away?
I'm just having fun with my new friend, that's all.
Wait, we gonna have a problem?
No, there's no problem here. I was just hoping you might give me some insight into the evolution of the market economy in the southern colonies. My contention is that prior to the Revolutionary War, the economic modalities, especially in the southern colonies, could most aptly be characterized as agrarian pre-capital.
All right, of course that's your contention. You're a first-year grad student. You just got finished reading some Marxian historian, Pete Garrison, probably. You're going to be convinced of that till next month when you get to James Lemon. Then you're going to be talking about how the economies of Virginia and Pennsylvania were entrepreneurial and capitalist way back in 1740. That's going to last until next year. You're going to be in here regurgitating Gordon Wood, talking about, you know, the pre-revolutionary utopia and the capital-forming effects of military mobilization.
As a matter of fact, I won't, because Wood drastically underestimates the impact
of social distinctions predicated upon wealth, especially inherited wealth. You got that from Vickers. Work in Essex County, page 98, right? Yeah, I read that too. Were you going to plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter? Or is that your thing? You come into a bar, you read some obscure passage, and then pretend you pawn it off as your own? As your own idea, just to impress some girls, embarrass my friend. See, the sad thing about a guy like you is in 50 years, you're gonna start doing some thinking on your own, and you're gonna come up with the fact that there are two certainties in life. One, don't do that. And two, you dropped 150 grand on a fucking education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library.
Yeah, but I will have a degree, and you'll be serving my kids fries at a drive-thru on our way to a skiing trip.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but at least I won't be unoriginal. But, I mean, if you have a problem like that, I mean, we could just step outside. We could figure it out.
Oh, man, there's no problem. It's cool.
It's cool?
Yeah.
Cool.
Fucking damn right it's cool. How you like me now?
And my boy is wicked smart, as Casey Affleck says in the very next second or so. I apologize for the language there, and I didn't give you any kind of a heads up or warning on the front end. But that right there, right? That right there is what happens relative to the common man in academia. If the common man is not even necessarily conservative, but independent and not for every decision being made for him, all of his thinking being done for him, his being boxed out in the marketplace of ideas, in the actual straight up economic marketplace, you know, where you buy, sell, trade goods and services. The common man that's tired of being boxed out in this case, actually very much along the lines of George Gilder's term, the sexual marketplace, because what? The guy with the expensive clothes and the ponytail who goes to MIT can hold his being in pursuit of an advanced degree from a prestigious university over his head. Guy from the street, played by Ben Affleck, talking to some ladies, trying to obviously be charming and put on the moves, gets checked. And then in turn, you get this Matt Damon, who is Will Hunting, stepping up to the plate because, hey, you know what? I know this stuff too. In fact, I know it better than you do. Way ahead of you. And what's the trump card? The trump card is, I'm going to have a degree and a really great paying job, and you're going to be serving my kids French fries because you're not going to have an advanced degree and you're not going to get a good job. You're always going to be a loser. How do I know you're always going to be a loser? Because you're hanging out with this guy. How do I know this guy's always going to be a loser? Because he obviously doesn't have the advanced education that I have. It's just arrogant. It just reeks of pride and condescension. And yet, that's what we've come to expect from higher education in far too many cases. This is a large part of the cultural and political polarization that characterizes America right now. You have those with the advanced degrees who go into white-collar professions and they make really good money. And they associate their ability to make really good money with having gone to college. And so where do they send their kids? To college. Naturally. They insist their kids are going to go to college. What do they study? Who cares? What's their degree going to be in? Doesn't matter. You just need to go to college because that's where you get permission to get a really high-paying job. But all of that permission is contingent on you not standing up to the likes of the bully in this bar scene from Good Will Hunting. You don't stand up to that guy because he'll find a way to get even. He'll call in some favors with some friends who, if you are going to that school, maybe are going to make it a little less pleasant. If he's a professor, if he's the administration, if he's the DEI coordinator, if. And gradually over time, what this ends up producing is, I think, the graphs that we were just discussing from Commodore Vanderbilt's post at Not to Be. These white-collar professions, even if 2 to 4 decades ago they were much more conservative, much more balanced, even fairly even between folks who identified as on the right, folks who identified as on the left, you get it skewing to the left when the incentive structure is you will affirm these ideas, you will affirm DEI, or you will not be going to school here, you will not be working here, you will not be welcome in this association, this firm, this practice, this what have you. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Claudine Gay resignation business. Is it going to go much farther than her stepping down as president? Perhaps not. And if it doesn't, well, then we really do have something like a caste system. And it's not predicated on race per se, but then it is. I've seen some memes this week where she's pictured and then the captions are generated by somebody else, obviously. But she's claiming that people are calling for her to be fired because of her race, right? It's racial animus. No, no. The reason you were given the position in the first place is because of your race. It's despite the fact that you're a black woman who is very much in favor of DEI and social justice and advancing the climate change agenda at Harvard University through Harvard University. It's precisely because of those things that you were put in the position that you're in the first place, and it's because of those things that there's a reluctance to make you feel consequences that are negative for having plagiarized. And what's curious too, I mean, again, with the bar scene, the guy with the ponytail doesn't have any original ideas. And so isn't this just the problem too? That you have unoriginal thinking being rewarded. Because why? Because the really original thinking, that's supposed to be reserved for the most expert people. This is the model that you get when the administrative state wants to maintain the status quo, wants to protect its interest, and its interest is in being regarded as the most expert and therefore who everybody needs to get permission from to do anything. But then a consequence of that is the typical people who would drive innovation, because necessity is the mother of invention, the typical people who are living closer to zero than they are to $1 million a year, those people, when they do come up with a really innovative, creative idea, less and less are they welcome to pursue that idea without getting permission, without kissing the ring. They're too easy to pick off. They're too easy to shoot down if the administrative state starts to feel like, ooh, wow, I don't know. How are we going to regulate that? How are we going to tax that? If that's their first question, how are we going to regulate that? What if that disrupts other things that we're regulating? What if that disrupts tax revenues that we get elsewhere? If that's their first thought, well, then you know that this is really not about human flourishing. For the innovators, for the inventors, for the folks who pay $1.50 in late fees at their local library rather than paying $150,000 for a 4-year degree from MIT. Again, I'm coming up on a hard break, so I have to leave it there for right now. Our next episode is going to be subscriber only for the month of January, and then February 1st, it'll be available, and you can listen to it even if you're not a subscriber, but do consider signing up, subscribing for 99 cents a month. I'm not asking for $150,000, but if you wanted to get a good education in our next episode about more of these sorts of things, and every third episode after, consider signing up for 99 cents a month. Then I make a little bit of money producing more content. Even if you don't, it'll be there in about a month's time. But as always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.
You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.